Today is Monday. It's September 8th, 2025, and this is part 4 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Dave Mertz. Dave spells his last name M-E-R-T-Z. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Dave. How are you today?
I'm doing well.
Great. Dave, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. We left off at the end of part 3, and you had applied, check with your wife, Doris, to make sure she was okay with you applying for a fire staff officer job in Williams, Arizona, on the Kaibab National Forest, and if you got that job, y'all would be moving west. Can you pick that story up?
Yeah. I got selected for the job, and I moved out there, I believe, like the end of August 2005. And we went out there. We'd gone out for a house hunting trip, and I found out, that's when I found out, housing was kind of expensive out there.
But, yeah.
But, yeah, it was a bit of a shock.
Yeah.
But we did find a place in Williams.
Okay.
And then I got out there, and then my family followed me a month later. So
okay.
We got out there and got settled in. And, started learning a new job.
Tell me about it.
Well, it was I had previously been a forest fire management officer, but this was a step up from that as the fire staff officer for the forest.
What's the difference?
Well, the main thing is you work directly for the forest supervisor, and You manage the entire fire program.
Oh, wow.
And, And so, and then the Kaibab had a fairly good-sized fire organization, not as big as the Coconino, but still a fairly good-sized fire organization. Several million-dollar budget, and, So it was a different environment, different situations, and I look forward to it. It was an interesting new challenge for me.
Can you just describe the district? How big it is? Where did it range from? Where to where? And then who you work for? And what were they like?
Okay, so the forest. I'm trying to recall. I think it was something like 1.2 million acres
altogether.
There's two ranger districts on the south side, one in Williams, another is up at Tucson, on the south rim there, the Grand Canyon. And then the North Kaibab Ranger District, which is located up in Fredonia. And so that's on the north side of Grand Canyon. So there's three ranger districts, and then I worked directly for the forest supervisor. His name was Mike Williams, and he had already been there for 7 years.
Okay. Let's talk about the district before we visit about Mike. Between Williams and Fredonia is a Grand Canyon. And
well, but oh yeah.
So I was thinking, if you wanted to, go visit the North Rim, how did you get over there? That's from Williams. What? It's a 3 hour drive, 2.5 hour drive to get over there.
And more like a 4 hour drive.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, by the time you go over Flagstaff and you go up, and then you had to cross over to the Kaibab Plateau there into Fredonia. So yeah, it's 4 hours, but every once in a while, when things were going on, we needed to make the trip a lot quicker. We had a plane under contract and that would fly us up there. And then also, Grand Canyon had a plane and a pilot. And, sometimes we would get them to give us a ride. So,
okay.
Several times I would fly over the Grand Canyon and I was, appreciated that. It was when you fly right over the rim there, you know, it's, like the earth drops away.
Yeah.
It was, always a great view. You know, kind of one of those things where you were like, yeah, I'm getting paid to do this. That was
lovely job.
Yeah.
Except
one time we took out from Williams and we're heading north, and just before we went across the Grand Canyon, all of a sudden the motor sputtered.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And the three of us that were in the plane, we all kind of looked at each other, and then a little bit later, it sputtered again. And, luckily, the other guy who worked for me, he's riding with me, and he said, "Now we're gonna turn this around and land there at Grand Canyon."
Good.
Yeah, so we did. And we were kind of stuck, and we finally eventually got a ride around to the north side. But yeah, that was a little interesting. You don't want to be flying over the Grand Canyon and have your motor
correct
that
answer
die on. That wouldn't be good.
Did you find out what was wrong with the plane in the end?
Yeah, it was something like the magneto or something like that, and it was just misfiring or something.
Okay.
I guess.
Well, glad it just misfired, but then was back together for a while, so you could put the plane on the ground and replace that.
Yeah, me too.
Wow.
Well, I was not a fan to like you when you're up in a plane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was working for Mike Williams like? What was he like?
He's an interesting guy. He's very knowledgeable, probably. At that time in Region 3, the Forest Service Region 3, which is regional office, was in Albuquerque, and let's see, I think there was 11 national forests in Region 3.
Okay.
And he was probably maybe the most experienced forest supervisor. I'm not sure as far as, like, you know, the most time that he had in the job.
Okay.
He knew the job, he knew the Forest Service very well. He didn't have a deputy forest supervisor, which some other forests did, but he didn't, and he didn't really want one.
Okay.
He felt like he could do the job himself, and he did. He did a good job. And sometimes a little impatient and things like that, but you know, you just take those things as they can. But I'd say by and large that he and I got along pretty well.
Good.
Yeah.
Because you were reporting directly to him, and you were basically overseeing the entire fire management plan.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
What did your duties entail?
Oh, you know, big part was the budget and training and hiring, and we had the dispatch, which was for the Kaibab plus the Grand Canyon, so. That fell under us as well, so we had dispatch there in the supervisor's office. So
So Grand Canyon has its own dispatch center. That is Grand Canyon, I believe. It's also Glen Canyon. But they don't do fire, is that right? All the fire goes through the Williams dispatch?
That's correct. At least that's how it used to be. It's changed. But yeah, I think, you know, law enforcement and stuff, that was something different. But
right.
Fire was managed out of the Williams dispatch.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and, you know, I don't know altogether how many fire employees we had. I can't remember. There's quite a few.
And that dispatch was out of your office there with the Forest Service in Williams.
That's correct.
Okay.
And then, you know, I was part of the Forest Leadership Team, and so you'd have your monthly meetings and talk about all the various things going on the forest that we had to coordinate and all that kind of stuff. So,
okay.
I don't know, it kept me busy, especially, you know, even when fire season was on. You're dealing with all that and oversight of that.
So when you came in 25
in
September.
2005.
Yeah, sorry, in 2005. The fire season was kind of on the downswing.
Was that right? Say that again, you cut out there.
In 2005, when you came to Williams, I would assume that the fire season was damping down.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, the fire season, once you get into the fall there, it's, you know, things calm down pretty good.
Yeah. Okay.
Until the following spring.
Yeah, and that would have been nice because it allowed you to kind of, you know, deal with everything else and wouldn't have to deal with active fire.
Correct, yeah. It was a good transition time. Got to kind of settle in and learn people and the way of the land, basically.
Okay. Cool. So who else did you work with?
Well, we coordinated quite a bit with the Grand Canyon. You know, Dan O'Trogi was the park's fire management officer.
Okay.
And so, you know, we did quite a bit with them, training, stuff like that.
What do you remember about Dan?
Dan's kind of an interesting guy, too. He was a type 1 IC at that time. He had his own incident management team. So he's kind of big in the whole fire circle and all that. Very kind of outgoing guy. I liked him.
Uh-huh.
Doug Otteson, he worked for me. He used to work for Dan, and him and Dan did not get along. So I don't know what all went wrong there, but, more or less I got along pretty well with him.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Dan's wife, Maureen, was the public relations officer at Grand Canyon.
Yes, now that you say that, it reminds me I'd forgotten about that.
Okay. And Doug, did he work out of Flagstaff or was he out of Williams as well?
He worked out of Williams. He worked right there with me.
Okay.
Next door to me. He lived in Flagstaff.
Got it.
But when he worked up at the park, he lived up there.
What was Doug like? What do you remember about him?
Oh, Doug, yeah, he was kind of an interesting guy, too. I mean, we got along pretty well. Actually, we got along really well, you know, over time.
Mm-hmm.
He took a little bit of getting used to. He was kind of opinionated and, you know, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But once I got used to him, and he'd been up at the park for a number of years and then decided to take that job down on the Kaibab.
Okay.
So he'd been around, in that area for quite a while, knew a lot of people and stuff, so he knew his job pretty well.
Cool.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about the relationship between the Park Service and the Forest Service? Of course, the park kind of has the same jurisdictional issues. They have a big canyon between the North Rim and the North Rim developed area and the South Rim and the South Rim developed area and all of the lands on both sides of the canyon extending for many, many miles east and west. And the Kaibab doesn't have so much extension east and west because there's another forest district off to the west, I believe, the Mount Trumbull district. Is that right?
I don't remember for sure. I don't remember. That.
I think they're out of Kanab, maybe? Maybe not.
Are they? Yeah. Boy, I just don't remember that.
But on the south side, the forest on the south side, on the west end, that's the Hualapai Reservation, and they've got Forester. Out there. A guy named Tom, and I'm spacing on his last name.
I don't think I ever met.
Okay.
Well, it is an interesting situation with the canyon there in the middle. And then over time, after, I don't know, I've been there for, I don't know, 2.5-3 years, something like that, maybe. We started, Dan and I started talking, and we said, have you heard of like this Service First where, you can set up these agreements where Forest Service and Park Service, for instance, they work together to, accomplish basically the same thing and make an organization, that could be more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to go down that road, and the fire organization on the North Kaibab and the North Rim, we basically combined those into a Service First organization, and then we, I don't know if you, did you know Ed Hyatt? Did you know him?
No.
He was the FMO on the North Rim there.
Okay.
And, so we basically gave him a promotion to a GS-12, and he took over and managed the fire organization for both the North Rim and the North Kaibab. So, and I believe it's still functioning that way.
Okay.
But there was a few growing pains, but yeah, I really think it made sense, made a lot of sense. And
how did it work, Dave?
Well, I mean, because the park had fire people stationed there at the North Rim, and we had our organization there at Fredonia, and they just started to transition and manage that whole piece of ground from the Grand Canyon North as one organization.
Okay.
So the Forest Service people would work on the park, and the park people would work on the Forest Service, and it didn't matter where the work was at, they just all worked together. And it worked pretty well. Hopefully it's still working that way.
I mean, it sounds like a good idea because you have resources for the Kaibab National Forest on North Rim and the fire, Grand Canyon National Park, wildland fire and structural fire would have resources based out of the North Rim developed area.
And it really made a lot more sense than to say, oh, no, here's this artificial boundary between the two. You know, that really didn't make any sense.
Right.
It made a lot more sense to just combine resources and essentially combine the budget together and run it all as one organization.
Okay.
And so, yeah, there was some growing pains. But we worked through that, and I think it actually worked pretty well.
Cool.
Like I said, as far as I know, it's still that way. I don't know that for sure. And hopefully it's working well.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Ben, what was the 2006 fire season like?
Well, that was kind of an exciting, interesting time because, you know, you start getting into the spring and, you know, they had fire season there. But, you know, we hadn't had anything getting too crazy. And then the North Kaibab, the Kaibab had some history of what they called wildfire use, you know, back then, which is, they call them that managed fire today.
Okay.
But mostly that had been on the south of the forest. Not so much on the North Kaibab. The Grand Canyon on the North Rim had, you know, had a history of doing that, but not so much on the forest there. And so we had a fire, a natural lightning ignition. It was on the west side of the highway, south of Jacob Lake there. And we had had some rain, and the ranger there, Jill Leonard was her name, she and her FMO decided, well, we'd like to, you know, manage this as a fire use fire.
Okay.
So we agreed to that, and then back in those days, they had these teams that were specially set up to manage fire use fires. And there was a team up in Colorado, Bill Honenberg, he was the IC, and we got them to come down and they were assigned to that fire. And the way that those work, you initially identify a management area that your goal is to let it grow to that, and that's where you're gonna set your boundaries to.
Okay.
And so we did that. I think they call them maximum manageable area, MMAs, they call them. And you know, I don't know, not several days maybe went by, and the fire jumped the highway there. You know, the highway that goes down to the North Rim.
Yeah, Highway 67.
Yeah, 67.
Right.
And
was that one of the management area boundaries? Highway 67?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was. And so the ranger and the FMO and the fire use team, they've been getting good results with the fire, and they said, well, we'd like to adjust our managing area here and let it continue to grow on the east side of the highway.
Okay.
And so, you know, we kicked that around and decided to go ahead with that.
And what would you look at for your criteria for that? Would that be weather and wind and resources and fuel moistures and all that stuff?
All that stuff.
Okay.
And they had a fire behavior analyst on the team, you know, that's doing modeling and pretty sure we had a meteorologist on the fire too. And so you look at all those considerations.
Okay.
And we decided they redrew the management area for the fire and then it moved towards the east. And things went pretty well for some period of time. I don't remember how long. Maybe a week and a half, something like that. And then things started, you know, we hadn't gotten any additional rain and it was starting to get more active than what we wanted to see. Well, the problem was, by this time, the fire started, by the way, like, I don't know, June 5th or something like that. So we were getting well into June by that time, and then other fires had started to pick up in the region. And so the fire use team was requesting resources, extra resources. Well, at the regional office, they said, well, we can't send you very much because they're busy working on these other fires. And by the way, you're just a fire use fire, you know. And so we weren't having success at bringing in additional resources.
So hang on a second to make sure I understand
this. Yeah.
Because a fire is a fire.
True.
And if you have a wildfire use fire started by lightning, it's just the same as any other fire started by lightning. I can understand it makes sense that resources are only so big, and so, you know, I would assume that every fire is clamoring for resources, and somebody's got to figure out who gets what.
That's it right there. I mean, you know, basically at the regional level, they have kind of have to triage things, you know, and we probably fell out lower on the totem pole.
Well, would they also say, look, you know, that fire on the Kaibab, it's got Grand Canyon resources to help it?
Yeah, well, you know, to some extent, I mean, we were being pretty clear that we needed additional help and we weren't really getting it.
Okay.
So, at that point, we were kind of getting a little bit in a bind. And then it was predicted that we were going to get a wind event and a wind shift, which would have been a northeast wind, which is not really what we needed. And so at that point, things were getting a little hairier. And then we decided we were going to transition to a regular Type 2 incident management team, and we got one of the ones from Arizona that they were going to be assigned. Well, they were going to report the next day, which I believe was a Sunday, but on that Saturday, the wind came up, and I drove up there to see what was going on, and it was, it grew fast. I mean, and the only hope, it was a northeast wind, and the only hope really we had was was it was blowing up to the southwest, and it was going to hit that Highway 67, and we hoped that we could, you know, hold it at the highway, keep it on the east side of the highway. Even though we did have a section on the west side of the highway up by Yucca Blake, but all that was pretty well contained. But, and so then that evening at dark, I was down there on the highway with the fire crews that was there on the highway. It just blew across that highway like it wasn't even there. And it just kept going. And so then the next morning the new team, they transitioned in, and luckily sometime during that day the winds kind of died down, but by that time I had went for an additional, you know, I don't know, 35,000 acres, you know, in just a couple days or so. But then, I mean, we got kind of lucky. We did get the resources then, and we got what we needed, and things went pretty well, and we kind of got things wrapped up in a few days. But
did you bring in air resources for that?
Oh yeah, we had air tankers, helicopters, and
okay.
We definitely bumped up on the priority list, you know, at that point.
Right, when your fire expands that amount of size in that amount of time, they're like, "Oops, we better."
Yeah,
put some resources over there.
You know, the people that were down at the North Rim, you know, old Trogan called me up and goes, "What in the world's going on?" And I said, "Well, it's not good. And you better, you know, you gotta keep everybody there at the North Rim." And they did. I'm thinking for 2 or 3 days. And then they figured out a route on the west side there on gravel roads that they
they
got people out that way. So,
out to Fredonia on the old logging road, which was a nice graded road.
Yes, yeah, they got them out that way. So that worked out. I mean, and you know, no structures were lost. All we did is burn up a bunch of trees.
Right.
And so I stayed around up there for a few days while all that was going on, and then lo and behold, things were kind of wrapping up, and that's like I told you the other day, that's when we got that big rain that came in, and I was out there on the forest when it was happening, and that's when I got to see just what happens when you get a rain like that on freshly burned ground. It was, I don't know, I just thought it was incredible.
What did you see?
Well, the ash flows that were coming off the fire and down through any low spot, you know, there was just that mix of water and ash. In some cases, you know, I don't know, maybe 2 to 3 feet deep, you know, of these ash flows that were just flowing. It was really incredible to see. I wouldn't have ever, I don't know, something you had to see. And then, you know, we were hearing that they was turning the river black down there.
Right.
From all the ash flows.
This is down on the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon.
Absolutely, yeah. They were saying that they were having ash flow in the river. And
did they have a fish kill down there from this?
I never heard that.
Okay.
I don't know. I guess it's certainly possible, but so, and you know, all together that fire, but a lot of it, the first part was what you'd call a good fire. It did pretty well. But I think the entire size of the fire was 50,000 or something, but the part where it burned in those 2 days was maybe 30 some thousand, but so that's pretty small compared to the fire they just had. So I can't imagine what kind of ash flows they're getting out that. But
right. Well, they're going to need that key element of rain, and I don't know if they've had that yet.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it'll happen sooner or later.
We'll see. One of these days. Yeah.
Yeah.
How does that work when you have a fire and then suddenly it's really burning and you have to bring in way more resources and you have to bring in air support? This is really expensive stuff. How does the budget work for that? I mean, I'm just thinking that the Dragon Bravo fire this summer is over almost $110 million now.
Yeah.
Where does that kind of funding come from?
Well, that's a good question. Back at that time, you know, there's a suppression budget, and with those, I don't know how it is now, but I mean, forever they were what you call P codes. They were a P, a letter P, and then some numbers.
Okay.
And you charged to that P code. But back then, if you had a fire use fire, it wasn't classified the same as with a P code. You got, I think it was an S code.
Okay.
And so you got a special kind of code, funding code, for that fire.
Okay.
But then when we transitioned to it was a suppression fire, then it was assigned a P code, but nonetheless, both of them come out of, you know, the national fire budget.
Okay.
Which, you know, that's kind of complicated. It's not a bottomless pit, but it's a big pot of money. So, and you know, in the past, there's always, you know, a certain amount of money designated for that. And then when that gets all spent and Congress has to do something else on emergency funding or something like that. But,
okay.
Yeah. So I don't remember how much money we spent on that fire, but it wasn't anywhere near what they spent on this one. It, you know, right. I'm guessing maybe a couple $1 million there, but nothing like what they're doing.
And that fire in 2006 was called the Warm Fire?
Yeah, the Warm Fire. And the reason it got that name was there was this, where the fire actually started, there was a spring, and it was called Warm Spring. And that's how I got the name of the Warm Fire.
Okay.
There wasn't anybody trying to be a wise guy or anything
right.
like that. It was just named after a geographic location.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was hard. And then, of course, we had a lot of people that were upset with us. People in Fredonia, people in Kanab. People on the forest were upset with us. I'm sure people on the park were upset with us too. It was we had people upset, and understandably so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but we pretty quickly we held a town hall meeting down in Kanab.
Okay.
And, opened it up to the public, and we sit there and answer their questions and took it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's what we had to do.
Yeah.
And, people vented. People with Jacob Blake were not very happy with us because they thought they might lose their business, and understandably so. But and we had some, you know, some bad press coverage, and kind of interesting that it kind of got dragged back up again with this latest fire. They, you know, brought up some of the old warm fire stuff again.
Oh, interesting.
So, you know, it happened.
Yep.
For me personally, what I learned, some of the worst judgmental people when it comes to wildfires is other fire people. You know, they like to point out what somebody else did wrong.
Mm.
And, you know, the implication being that they would never be that stupid.
Okay.
And you know what? I'd participated in that myself in the past. You know, you always think, and part of it is, I think you tell yourself, well, that can't happen to me.
Right.
You know, I got everything under control. It won't happen to me. Well, it did. It did happen to me.
Right. Until it does.
Right. Until it does. And I thought, well, you know what? That being judgmental, I'm going to be a lot more careful about that. And
right.
I've tried to do that ever since.
Mm, uh-huh.
And that's like with this dragon variable fire. I'm like, hey, they might have certainly, from what I know, I mean, they screwed up big time. But I don't know that for sure, and I want to wait to see what all happened before.
Right.
Before I cast judgment. But I understand how that happened. People are really upset, and I'm upset that happened there. But
right. You know, since we're talking about it, let's journey in there a little bit. The latest fire here at the North Rim that burned out of the Grand Canyon National Park into the Forest Service lands, and then out of the Forest Service lands into the Bureau of Land Management lands to the east.
Yeah.
Down in House Rock there. One of the things that happened early on in that fire, When the Dragon Bravo fire was doing good, was a nearby fire, about 50 miles to the north, called the White Sage.
Right. Yeah.
Took off and burned out of BLM land into Kaibab National Forest land. So one question I had was, you had this working relationship with Grand Canyon National Park.
Right.
The two agencies, service first, working together.
Yeah.
Did the BLM get in on that at all?
No.
Okay.
Unless that changed, but it mm-hmm. happened back when I was there.
Right.
It certainly could have. I mean, we could have gone that route, but we didn't.
I mean, I wouldn't think BLM land would burn, but, you know, because it's normally sagebrush, but
does.
There it goes. So.
Yeah, I've been on those sagebrush fires. And,
okay.
And that north end of the North Kaibab District, you know, it's mostly pinyon juniper and, you know, just brush up there.
Yeah, pinyon juniper, that's right, which can happily burn.
Yeah, fires go through that pretty quick.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting question. It's like, wow, you already got another fire going on, and you're gonna manage another fire down here.
Right.
There's a lot of things that don't seem right. But I just wanna. I assume somebody's gonna do a good job of a review on that. And we'll find out, and it's surprising to me because, I mean, the North Rim there, they had a decent history of managing fires, and it surprised me that this happened, because I don't know how many people are left over there from when we had the warm fire, you know, but, I mean, certainly we learned some lessons there.
Well, you know what the reason I was kind of heading off into the Dragon Bravo was because you mentioned that one of the things that happened with the warm fire that you learned, it sounds like after the fact, was you realized the fire was going to get big. You asked for resources and didn't get them.
And yes, that was a key factor.
So for the Dragon Bravo, here's a fire that seems to be doing okay, in quotes. And there's an adjacent fire that clearly needs resources quickly. It's growing by leaps and bounds and causes the North Rim fire people to say, let's get the tourists out of here because it looks like the fire is going to cut Highway 89A off entirely, and those people will have no way out. They have to use the old gravel road that they used for the warm fire, while Trogi used to get those people out there.
Yeah.
So could that fire, the warm fire, have pulled resources away from the Dragon Bravo fire at a critical time when resources were needed at both fires?
Certainly. I mean, it certainly seemed like that could be the case. And so that's just one of the things that doesn't seem to add up. I just don't know if they just totally underestimated what they had there. But one of the big things that we learned, because on the Kaibab, we went on and did a number of fire use fires after the warm fire. We didn't. The Force Supervisor, Mike Williams, he was supportive, and he said, no, we're not going to stop doing this. But one of the big lessons we learned was, you know, in that country, you're going to have a wind event. It's not when you're going to have one. It's when.
Right.
And so you don't want your fire getting big and then have a wind event. And so what we learned was, and there was these kind of like fire use purists, you know, they were like, oh, you just gotta let the fire do its thing. Well, we were like, no, we've been there, done that. We're not doing that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would come up with our management area and we would help it do its thing and get it over. We didn't let fires go on for days and days.
Okay.
Because you're just opening yourself up to one of those wind events.
Uh-huh.
And then it's going to ruin your day. And
right.
And if anybody had on the North Rim there had said, hey, we should call old Birch for the warm fire and see what he said, I would have said, you're going to do it. Do it and get it over with. Don't just sit there and let it burn and then wait till you get some wind event, which
right.
is what happened.
So back me up a little bit. When I think of fire use fires, they're called these managed fires. They are in opposition. Opposition is not the right word, but they are in contrast to a prescribed fire.
Correct.
Where you have better fuel burning conditions with increased moisture, and you can really work the fire for its beneficial effects without the risk of it running away.
Yeah, because you've already got all your lines prepared. You know, you've got a definite boundary that you're going to contain that prescribed fire in, and you also, when you do up your burn plans and stuff, you determine what the resources you're going to need to do that, and then you have to have those resources.
Okay.
Otherwise, you can't do it. And so, with the fire use fire, it's a little different because that's a naturally occurring event in a brand new place. And possibly you did some pre-planning, but a lot of it is you gotta make it up on the fly. And you gotta start getting your resources there and, you know, all that. So it's two different endeavors, that's for sure.
Right. And it would make sense that the fire use fires, or the managed fires, natural start. Well, that means that conditions are ready to burn. And prescribed fires are typically in the fall or the spring or the winter. And it seems as like these fire use fires happen in the summer when it's hot and dry and
when you get lightning.
Right, when you get lightning, exactly. And things catch on fire,
you gotta have lightning. That was one of the things people said about the warm fire. Like, what were you thinking? You're letting a fire grow in June, which is, typically the height of our fire season here. What were you thinking? Well, our thinking was we had pretty good rain prior to that fire. And so that's what gave us the thinking that we could do this. The problem was it went on for, a couple of weeks, and we didn't get any more rain.
Right.
By then, in 2 weeks in northern Arizona, around that time of year, things can change pretty dramatically. And, you got to take all that into account, and we should have done a better job of that.
Well, in your defense, I would ponder, as a layman knowing nothing, that once you get to the point where you realize, gee, we're not getting any more rain, it's really starting to dry out, without a ton of air power, even then, it's hard to put these things out.
Yep. We another one of the lessons learned was that original management area that we had, we should have kept that. When it crossed the highway and we decided that we're going to let it get bigger, that was a mistake.
Okay.
And so that was a big decision. And it should have been taken more seriously than what it was. And so, that was one of the lessons learned. If we'd stuck with what we had, everything would have worked out. Fine and dandy. But that's not how it worked out.
And in the case of Grand Canyon, I think by the time that fire, when they had their wind event, it had dried out. And of course, it was way more dry than 2006. There had been no summer monsoons the year before, 50% of winter snows, no monsoons to speak of this summer before the event. There was a little bit of rain that started the fire with a lightning strike, which actually seemed like a pretty good amount of rain. I think maybe a couple tenths of an inch. So, I'd say, well, that's a good rain there.
That's probably what made them think they could do that.
Right. And you expect more to come.
Right.
But it didn't.
Right.
It turned tail and moved back south. And so now you've got a fire and there's... So it's just all these events are kind of coming together.
Right. And, boy, like I said, I'm curious to see... Start to wonder if anybody's there that was there for the warm fire, because they should have learned some lessons, from what happened there.
Yeah, this is a...
Sounds like a lot of some similarities, who knows what really happened. I hope we'll find out.
One of the similarities is a summertime fire. And if you look back on the records of all the fires that have kind of blown up and gotten big, they've all happened in this time frame in the summer, when fire conditions are at their peak for burning, for wanting to burn.
True. But I heard talk by a guy this last week that he said, if this fighting the bigger fire problem, you know, across the West. He said, it's never going to be solved. You have to have fire on the ground.
Right.
And if you can only wait till when it's perfect, it's never going to work out.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, that was his take. I think you made a decent point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and we brought up this Dragon Bravo fire, and he said, yeah, it's bad. But, he said, but that kind of negates all the other ones that actually work out.
Right.
You know, so he said, if you take something like that and say, okay, well, we can't ever manage fire again, he said, that's not the right, in his opinion, not the right message. So.
Right, right. And so the next question, that kind of begs the next question, which is, how do you burn in the summer without going catastrophic? And maybe that's just what it's going to be.
Well, you burn in the summer and
you try to contain it, but if it kicks your ass, it kicks your ass.
Yeah, well, to some extent, there is that. I mean, I think if you get well-trained people and you get very aggressive, and you manage it within a certain area in a short time frame, you can do it and get away with it. But
mm-hmm.
this letting it go for days or weeks
mm-hmm.
probably is a recipe for disaster, I think.
And it's also interesting because it by this point, by 2025, things are just getting worse and worse. Temperatures are going
yes.
up. The weather conditions are drying out, and the forest is still standing there waiting to burn.
Yes, because you know here's another thing on the North Kaibab. As you head from Jacob Lake and you head down towards the northern, of course I don't know what it's like now, but when you get to that Kaibab Lodge,
yep.
there, so, you know. It kind of transitioned to that mixed conifer, not just ponderosa pine. And I mean, it's just chock full of trees. And,
right.
And we always knew, oh my, get a fire in here, it's not going to go well.
That's right.
And the reason that the forest looks like that there is because they suppressed all the fires for 100 years.
Right.
And that's, you see, now you got that mess.
Yeah.
Well, maybe now they don't have that mess because it's all burned up. I don't know.
Right.
But it was a time bomb waiting to go off.
Right.
Know? And without spending a whole lot of money, you know, there really was no fix to that.
I wonder about the rest of the Kaibab, though. So this fire, they used the DeMont Park, Highway 67, north-south, big wide open grassland section there, as a fire line, and that worked real well. Well, what
yeah.
that means is all that mixed conifer to the west is just waiting to burn.
It's still there.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the fix is for that.
Mm.
I really don't.
Gotta wonder.
Yeah, you gotta wonder.
One more question I had for this. Someone had mentioned that the agency can get money for acres burned in a fire use fire. Does that make sense? Had you heard that?
Well, maybe what you're thinking is at some point along the way, you know, the Forest Service was getting a hard time because, you know, there's always this pressure to tree acres, right?
Yep.
And you know, a lot of times people think that's logging, but then they also said, boy, if you get a wildfire and it's getting the effects you desire, you could count that as acres treated. And so, you know, you got credit for acres treated with prescribed fire. That's no problem. But then they also opened it up to the wildfires, and if they said, you know, you got desired effects, you could count those as acres treated. So I'm thinking maybe that's what you...
Maybe. What does acres treated counting do for you?
Well, you get a certain amount of money in the budget, basically, to treat fuels. And so tied to that is a target. And so you're getting money and you got an associated target. And so, you know, four supervisors like to look good and they like to show their boss that they're meeting their target. And so they can then say, hey, you know, we met this target. So
okay.
It's all kind of a funny business thing.
Yeah, because it, you know, the question was, well, is there any kind of incentive to allow a burn like this to burn?
There is an incentive, and it certainly, I don't know what the current environment, but there was an incentive and maybe, you know, a little pressure on forest supervisors to manage fires.
Okay.
You know, because then, you know, they can say, well, we treated more acres.
Right.
There's always that pressure in the, you know, the chief of the forest is, the Forest Service is in a committee hearing there in D.C. and they're grilling them, you know, and it's all about numbers.
Right.
So there is pressure.
But here's another, you know, here's another straw on the camel's back. Along with, you know, maybe resources were thin because of the White Sage fire. Maybe the weather turned and they weren't thinking about it. Maybe the fire jumped the containment line and they didn't have enough resources. And they're thinking, well, let's go ahead and let it just burn along because of, you know, we can, this will look good on the numbers sheet.
It'll look good on the numbers, but I'm also pretty sure they're trying to do the right thing.
Right.
Know? Trying to do what they think is the right thing.
Right.
And well-intentioned, sometimes those don't work out so well.
Yeah.
So to kind of wrap up the warm fires, a number of years went by, and then I think it was 3 years ago,
uh-huh.
I decided, you know, that was a kind of a big moment in my life. I'm going to drive down there and see what it looks like today.
Cool. What did you see?
And I did. I went down there. I hadn't been there ever since I'd left the combat, which was in 2011. And so I went there. And, you know, as I was driving towards the fire, I was afraid of what I was going to see. And I got there, and I was like, oh, my goodness. It was chock full of aspen.
Okay.
Just, as far as I can see, it was aspen about, I don't know, 15 foot tall aspen. And, I was so glad to see that because I was afraid, you know, it would just be a grassland.
Right.
And on the east side, off the plateau there where it got down into the pinyon juniper, that didn't really recover too good.
Okay.
But up on top, it was almost all that I saw had converted to aspen. And, you know, gotta be one of the larger aspen stands in the country.
Nice.
I mean, it's huge. Yeah. So I was glad to see that. It made me feel a little better about the whole thing.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, I think, which is in the scope of geologic time, this will all work out.
Yeah, it will. And, you know, right now, they're just so dense, I think it has been. But they'll kind of select and, you know, some of them will get bigger and they'll thin out and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And really, people, my prediction is people will drive from miles away in the fall to go up and see how beautiful that looks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just absolutely gorgeous when the aspen leaves turn in the fall.
Yeah.
That's, we've done that so ourselves.
It wasn't a desirable outcome. Yeah. It's not what I wanted to see happen.
Right.
But in the end, it could have been worse.
Yeah. Yeah. And only time will tell now on what will happen with this fire and subsequent fires thereafter, which we can assume will continue to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the pressure is on right now, you know, Frank Carroll being one of them, that they don't want to see any more managed fires. And I understand that viewpoint. I disagree with it, but I understand it.
Right. I mean, is he talking about all managed fires all year round, or just during certain months when the conditions are at their worst for burns?
Well, maybe he would nuance it that way a little bit, but I mean, he pretty well comes across that he's just pointing against them.
Hmm. Okay.
And he's not alone. I mean, there's a lot of other people like that.
Right. When did you meet Franklin on the? Did you meet him on the Kaibab, or did you meet him on the Coconino back in the day?
I didn't meet him on the Coconino back in the day, but when I left the Kaibab in 2011 for this job up here on the Black Hills, he was a natural resource staff officer, so I had fire, but I also had timber management and a number of other programs under me. So I came here to the Black Hills and had my office, and right next to me was Frank. So
okay, so you met him there. Got it.
Yeah, that's how I met him.
All right. All right. Something else about the Dragon Brower fire I wanted to ask you, but I can't remember what it was right now. So why don't we think about putting a comma in this interview series here, because we did a really good job, I think, of going through the Warren fire in 2006, but I'm probably thinking that wasn't the last fire you saw, and it wasn't the last thing you did for the Kaibab.
No, I had some more adventures there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, let's pick that up next time. And is there anything you want to add to the material that we've covered today?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, with that, let's conclude part 4 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with David Mertz. Today is Monday. It's September 8th, 2025. My name is Tom Martin, and Dave, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.